Hey guys, welcome to Hope It Helps. Today's guest is Kim Thompson. Kim is the founder and managing director of Raw Coffee Company. Kim, along with her partner Matt, held the first International Specialty Coffee Association diploma qualification in the MENA region. And over the past 17 years, they have built one of the strongest regional coffee brands led by a passion to support all areas of the coffee supply chain. During this episode, we discuss her story building Raw and the early days. We talk about the importance and the complexities of the coffee supply chain, how coffee cultures differ globally, and the past, present, and future of the UAE coffee market. And the last message she wanted to share is don't let it be intimidating to start your coffee journey. Just find a place where you feel comfortable. Please join me in welcoming to the show, Miss Kim Thompson.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. So let's, just to give context to everyone listening. So I actually met Kim at the Sharjah Entrepreneurship Festival about maybe a month ago now. And I never knew, obviously I'd known of Raw for a very long time, but I never knew of you, you know. I didn't know you were the person behind it and so on. So we had a chance to catch up and to meet at Raw, which at that festival, which was really, really awesome. And I've been a big fan of Raw for a long time. So, and I'm obsessed with coffee. So anyone in that space is someone that I'm always excited to talk to.
Thank you. There's a lot of you. So there's a lot of people that are obsessed with coffee.
Yeah. And so for me, I kind of like how I was telling you off camera that Raw was the first place I remember growing up that opened me up to different types of coffee. So that's when I discovered things like cold brew. That's when I heard about something called specialty coffee. I didn't know what specialty coffee was. So that was my first, I guess, entrance into the, like, oh, there's a bigger world of coffee than the Nescafe that I drink or whatever that might be. And then, so my coffee journey, I'd like to say, really started, though, in 2019. A friend of mine who's a barista, he came and stayed with me while I was living in Amsterdam, and he was just making iced V60s every day. Then after about a week or two, I'm like, okay, you're making this every day. Could you make me one? Let me try it. And after that first sip, the rest has been history. You know, now you can see I've got my own setup, you know, and do, and I grind every day and so on. And it's such a beautiful world. Coffee is such an interesting world.
It becomes a ritual, hey?
It does.
Yeah.
And so I make my coffee every morning, and it's the process is part, not only the end result is what I'm looking for, but the process of making it and like, oh, do I need to change the water? These beans might need that. You know, it's always a test, which is what keeps it fun.
Yes. And it's supposed to be fun.
Okay. Could you build on that a little bit? Because I think sometimes...
Or experimental.
Could you build on the fun aspect of coffee? I guess I think so many people.
You know, it's like anything. Once you introduced to a better quality version of whatever you're drinking or eating, it's very hard to go back go back to what you used to have and spend the same amount of money often, hey?
True.
And then, you know, buying your beans and making your coffee at home, it's costing you less than it is if you were buying it from a cafe.
Exactly.
And you're not always guaranteed to find a cafe that's going to make it properly or to your liking, maybe even, let's say, with that detail gone into it. Because it's all those variables you have to control with the quality of your water, the freshness of your beans, the grind size, all these things that you've taught yourself. And that's the beauty of the ritual, I think. And it's the same with matcha or tea or anything that involves a process and controlling those variables to make.
Yeah.
So if it's not fun, you're not going to do it.
True.
Or maybe it's about the end result for some people. And I have friends and business partners that are OCD. So I know for them what it's like. And, it, you know, that need for perfection.
Yeah.
And everybody has their own palate and their own preferences and their own flavors that they like. And it's part of our team at Raw, because the cafe at Raw is really like our showroom.
Yeah.
So it's our opportunity to proof of concept, show people what the potential of the coffees are. But you have to almost go in and guide a customer without intimidating them or scaring them, you know, to make it welcoming and to find out what they like, because it can be, it's personal. It's really personal.
Yeah, it's incredibly personal. And what I never realized until I got into coffee was that coffee, first of all, I never knew coffee was a fruit. Mm-hmm. When I first found that out, that shocked me. I'm like, how it doesn't look out of, where does it come from? Yeah. And only after you do some digging, you kind of see what it looks like. But what shocked me was what I find very exciting about it is the types of flavor profiles that you can get.
The potential of on offer
is crazy. So for me, on a personal note, I like coffees that don't taste like coffee. Mm-hmm. The fruitier it is, the jammier, the more mm-hmm. acidic, you know, I want to taste it and be like.
And is that processing methods as well as varietals? Like you like honeys or naturally processed coffees?
I'm not that specific. Okay. I haven't like to that okay. next layer of like yeah. washed, not washed.
Or, it can go like that too.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You could have, it blows my mind how the same bean mm-hmm. prepared in different ways mm-hmm. will give you three different taste profiles from one thing, whether you make an espresso or a V60, and it just blows my mind.
I think something that is a challenge, you know, our industry has lots of steps that happen to get it to you.
Exactly, yeah.
And the farmer has to work very hard, and, you know, he struggles with, if you think about where coffee grows around the equator, plus or minus 1,000 kilometers in the countries that we're looking at that are origins that grow coffee. This is a primary export for many of those countries. They rely on this income, and that's once a year they get to pick and harvest. And most of the really good coffee is small holder. You know, they might only have 2 hectares of land. So they might only have a couple of sacks that they produce. But to get the really beautiful single origin, you know, perfect, lovely coffees, it takes a lot of care that farmer picks the coffee only when it's ripe.
Yeah.
Not when he's run out of money and he needs to have that cash. You know?
Exactly, yeah.
And then it's not just the farmer, it's the people that are processing the coffee, because many of the farmers have to get their ripe cherries that they've picked immediately to a processing mill. And they might not have a truck. And they might not have a cooperative that they can all share the transportation. So maybe they're carrying it on donkey, you know, and there's often a lot of political challenges in many of these countries. And there's also a lot of corruption in a lot of these countries. So it's fraught with challenge just to get it to get processed.
Yeah.
And we pay more for often for coffees that are naturally processed. So they're dried with all the fruit on the outside, because there's more labor involved.
Yeah.
And then honey processed coffees, there's more risk of mold or all these other things. So it's also weather related, humidity related, volcanoes going off related. Yeah. You know? So there's a lot goes on. Then because it grows at altitude, it has to get to a seaport. And that final hulling has to happen. So there's a lot that they have to manage at that end before we even get the coffee.
Yeah, and I feel like listening, so I watched the recent podcast you did, and you were talking about how the supply chain of coffee, and how there's so many different market segments that if you wanted to get into coffee, you could get into, whether it's, you know, on this the trader side, or a cafe, or a roastery, or whatever the case might be. But what I took from that conversation is it seems like there's people in the coffee industry, people like yourselves, who've been in it for a long time, since day one, and have cultivated those strong relationships with like the farmers or every person in that supply chain to get that coffee to you. But for example, here, if we look around us here in Dubai, there's coffee shops popping up left and right. So I would struggle to imagine that even those guys are, I don't think those guys maybe underestimate or give enough credibility to that supply chain, and more importantly, to that farmer, who's, without him, you don't have a product.
I think we, we don't exhibit at World of Coffee or Gulf Foods or anything, because it costs a lot of money as a company to do that sort of thing. So we made the decision that we think it's more important to spend the money on origin trips to go and source and buy our green beans.
Okay.
So my business partner was in Ethiopia in December. We're heading to Mexico in March. And we have really strong relationships. Sometimes some of the farmers in the co-ops we've been buying for more than 15 years
there
from
you go.
Them.
Exactly.
And so they trust us. They know we're going to pay them. They know we don't argue. They know that we're looking for quality. Those relationships are really the main reason. There's two main reasons why Raw's doing well. One is those relationships with the farmers at Origin, because they're imperative to get to receiving the quality. And we like to have that control over our supply chain. And then the other is our team. So if you think about it, they're relationships.
Yeah.
It's people.
It's people, yeah.
And then the reason I'm grateful to have the opportunity to come and talk to people like you is because the more people understand about our industry, the more respect they'll show to the coffee they have, or the process that the baristas go through to give them their coffee. So
exactly,
you know,
it
is all about storytelling, and it's about sharing the farmer's story. And then if a consumer, like your, I would say your age group, your demographic, whether you're male or female, you're our target client, because you're conscious consumers. You care. And I think you care about where you spend your money. You care about the brands you support. And that's an extension of your personality.
Yeah.
So as we've gone on in our journey, we've learned to recognize the importance of that.
Yeah.
Because how do you stand out from the competition? You know, the coffee costs the same to buy a cup of coffee. In fact, I think we're cheaper than a lot of places to buy that cup of coffee. And yet we're spending a lot more money buying our green bean because it's a much better quality green bean. So we have to be able to tell that story to justify the pricing that the consumer has to pay.
Which is fair. And have you seen from your experience, because the difference between when, let's say, 20 people have come to Raw, bought a cup of coffee or a bag of coffee and left, and the others that maybe there was someone, maybe the barista there, or there was someone to convey that story, that extra add-on of like, oh, by the way, did you know this is where your coffee from, and this is what they do, and this is how. Have you seen that have a different, give you different feedback from the customers
for sure.
that like you have? Okay, sure. Yeah, because I was curious.
Yeah, and like we're trying to collect the analytics to understand whether it's from our website with the information we have on the products, or if it's our Instagram or our LinkedIn, or whether it's when people come in because they heard about us and so they see the screen that shows the information, and then they've talked to some of the staff. Or maybe they just go and ask to try a Mexican because they don't know what that tastes like. You know, it could be, it's a combination of all of it, and we have to work on all of it.
Yeah.
And I would say before I would have said that it was people coming into the actual facility to see our space and then buying a bag of coffee or having a cup of coffee. So it's down to our staff.
Mm.
Now I think the online story is probably as powerful.
Okay. You know, so you feel like nowadays things have become so digitally focused that a good, if you're conveying that story correctly online, that might remove the barrier that a customer would need to come in, see the space, get the full story.
Because everyone's
to get
busy,
that.
Hey?
There you go, exactly. Yeah.
And
yeah.
we're a destination. You have to actually come. We're not in a mall. We're not in an easy location. We're in our course.
Yeah.
So that might be intimidating for people. I don't know. Or maybe they don't have a vehicle. It's not a place where people walk around a lot. So I think that it's not a barrier, but I think it's showing a commitment to come.
It is. It is, for sure.
Now with TripAdvisor and Google reviews and all that type of thing, you can do a lot of homework before you
Absolutely,
travel
yeah.
to a place.
Yeah, yeah.
The problem we have, I honestly feel we have, is the greenwashing and the fact that other businesses use our language and use our terminology. It makes it very hard for the end consumer to distinguish what's real.
Mm, yeah.
So that's where we just have to be even better. And we have to be hope that because it's authentic, maybe it comes across as authentic better than it's just a sales marketing strategy.
That's true.
But, how do we know?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because I'm thinking about, I know you mentioned location-wise you guys are in Alcoa's and so on, but at least maybe I think if you're into coffee, I believe you'll make the trip to try that place that you've heard is you'll get a good cup of coffee, mm-hmm. or they have different types or so on.
I think I just mentioned to you when we met each other in Sharjah at the Entrepreneurial Festival, that was the first time we've attended that event, and we were invited to have a like a pop-up for the coffee. We completely underestimated how busy that event was going to be. So we only went down with a table, three baristas, you know.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And they were completely slammed. I came down to go to the opening and ended up putting on an apron and helping because the guys needed help.
Yeah.
And that was so much fun because that most of the demographic, the people that were down there were young.
Mm-hmm.
They were either really into coffee or really into matcha.
You know? It's either one of the two,
right?
It was
either one or the two. They were grateful we were there because, you know, they'd got there to go and listen to speakers and things and maybe hadn't had the time to go to a cafe or something. So we were really, we felt wanted, and we really loved seeing, because it was another emirate, which, you know, we're neighbours, it's close, mm-hmm. but to see that people knew us.
Yeah.
Because we weren't the only coffee option there, but we were really busy.
Yeah.
So that makes us feel good, obviously. And it reminds us not to be disconnected and to keep doing these things.
Mm, yeah.
You know, and go to these school fairs, go to these markets, go to Taste of Dubai, go and do all these things to reconnect with the consumer. Because even though we were the first and we're 17 years old, we can't be complacent.
Exactly,
because the easiest way to introduce someone to us is to pass them a cup of coffee.
There you go. Yeah. Coming on to what you were talking about, because on the podcast you mentioned that it had been a while that you've been like maybe behind the bar making like the coffee. I know you guys spent 5 years just perfecting like how to roast and mm-hmm. what's good. So do you feel like going through that experience, the longer route, if you want to call it, but you learned everything yourself. Did that serve you? Did those 5 years pay dividends later on as the business was growing?
Yeah, I think as a like an SME, a small business owner, at the beginning you have to learn how to do everything because you can't afford an accountant or a HR manager or a operations manager or an event coordinator, whatever it is. So, and that's something for any, I love encouraging people to start a company, but I think that's something that you have to go in with your eyes open, because you also need to be very honest to yourself and know what you're good and bad at.
Yeah.
Because you can't be good at everything.
True.
And we didn't even have a website when we started. Like, and Instagram wasn't around, so there wasn't the ability. We have a very cool application we use now to manage the records for our roasting and things like that. So things like that were not available. So everything was very manual.
Mm.
So you're forced to get to know how to do everything. But where do you add the most value?
That's the question,
I
guess.
So I think, you know, we have the best baristas. You know, every new company tries to steal them because, you know, they're so well trained and they know their stuff and they know their coffee. We also have really good waiting staff because they're the ones that are communicating often face to face with the customer, not the barista. So I think it's thinking about where, as you move through each stage, where do you add the most value? And whether that's the marketing, the PR, whether it's, for me, I think I have a very strong business partner. And he can look at a P&L sheet and a budget and see glaring issues that I don't even see.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that type of thing. So it complements each other. I believe a company's only as good as its people. So, you know, I tend to focus a lot on the human element and the communication for the company. But I would really struggle if I was the one that was doing all the finances mm-hmm. and the forward forecasting and things.
Yeah.
I'm lucky because I got to choose the things I was good at. So Matt's also really good at roasting coffee, but I get to roast the coffee because there's too many other things for him to do.
Exactly, yeah.
And so I have the team and the roasting. So I think it's if you're on your own, it would be very tough.
I would imagine so, especially in something I think like coffee, like a product like coffee, where it is so subjective. You could get 10 baristas from all over the world that might give you similar flavors,
actually,
different.
I think it's F and B.
and you think in general more,
the,
more
yeah, because people more so. Have their own, you know, what they're looking for with their avocado on eggs or whatever it might be, you know. It's everyone, and just to be always front facing and dealing with a customer, it's some days you have days when you don't want to do it.
For sure.
And the good thing about having a good team is that you can just pull back, and there are the days that you can let other people move forward.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And then, you know, the focusing on the direction that you want to go in, where you want to be in 3 years, and acting like a much bigger company than you are, I think has been something we've tried to do for a number of years, way before we were ready to. Mm-hmm. But that has, if we looked at the pain points like the supply chain, the right equipment manufacturers we want to work with, finding other suppliers who, you know, we get the disposable cups from or the crockery from or whatever it may be, but have an aligned value set has been, and it takes time to find them. You go through some printing companies that, you know, you don't gel with.
Yeah.
Or you don't, that just don't fit your future aim for where you see your company.
For sure.
And all of this makes you slower.
Yes, I guess.
But then it makes you your foundation strong.
Yeah, I guess then it's always that toss up, you know, do we want to move fast and like just learn as we go, or do we want to learn as we go, but let's take our time with this. Let's put the time in now so that later on, I would rather invest more time in the foundation than later, because I think later on it's easier if the foundation's strong.
Doing everything.
It's easier to build on if you've gone through, you know, that hard work.
If you have an investor,
that's a bit of a
you
different
have
story.
Expectations on you for return on your investment and their investment.
Yeah.
So I think the looking back, would we do it the same way a second time? Probably, because we had control, and both Matt and I had partners who had incomes coming in. If we didn't have that, and we were trying to live here and take, you know, honestly, 10 years to get the business to a point where it was not insolvent and, you know, financially sustainable. Yeah. Because I think sustainability, you have a obligation that has to be to the business and your employees as well as all the other, you know, environmental sustainabilities. We wouldn't have been able to do it that way if we'd had an investor.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they would have expected us to purchase cheaper green bean and improve our margin.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe have less staff and cut costs with, and maybe not, but from what we hear and what we see, I think the not having the investment and having the plan to go slow and build a brand, because that's what we've done, we've built a brand.
You have, yeah, for sure.
Then there's the value is in the brand.
Yeah, that's true, because even nowadays with all the coffee shops that are around and all the roasteries, everyone still remembers, you know, Raw, because you guys were the first.
Well, we're behind a lot of other businesses as well.
Do you do a lot of white labeling as well?
Yes, so we do white labeling. We source coffee for other businesses where there's nothing mentioned at all that it's Raw. And that's fine, because our goal is to sell bags of roasted coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
So it doesn't have to... I think we would have liked, you know, how Starbucks has that whole proudly serving. You know, it would have been great if we could have also grown the brand by having something like that. But I think it's... Now businesses are interested in that, but before they wanted to keep it quiet because it was their, you know, their secret, their point of difference. They didn't want.
Yeah, they don't want people to know. Yeah, because now I guess it's reached a point that there are a couple of suppliers in the market, but just because, again, this opens up. Coffee is so finicky at every stage. There's so many things that could go wrong. I could buy the top. Best quality coffee from Raw, from you guys, that has been graded, sourced, every single thing. And if I take it to a place that doesn't know how to make it correctly, or if I don't use it correctly myself, it just then all of that kind of just goes to waste.
And a lot of it can be down to, like, maybe they didn't change their water filtration.
Could be.
You know, and they've got really poor water, or maybe they didn't get their machine serviced this year, so the boiler's full of, you know, chlorides, and maybe their staff haven't been paid on time, so they're not feeling the love. You know, yeah. There's a whole lot of things that it can come down to.
Yeah.
But I think to, you know, yes, we have really expensive, beautiful, rare and experimental, you know, micro lots of coffee. And to make those perfectly and get the best coffee is, it's fun. It's amazing. But to have a regular priced single origin coffee from Myanmar or Mexico or Colombia or Peru and make that correctly, consistently, that's fun too.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, it's not sexy, but to have consistent quality is essential.
Yeah.
Because you can't buy these beautiful coffees and one of those variables not being controlled properly.
Exactly. It's just not going to work. And because, okay, this is a tricky question, because do you feel, because you can buy green beans from anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and the green bean, there's like, there's almost like phases where you could be like an expert. You could be the best farmer and you consistently produce a certain level of bean that has this many defects and so on. Like, I know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then if that is just, even as a roastery, because as a roastery, I feel like you're the final point of contact before I get to try this thing. So does more fall on the, more responsibility on that final cup fall, would you say, on the roaster or that original coffee? In the sense that I feel if through roasting, I can play around with what is potential, the potential of this, but if this is not farmed correctly, then no matter what I do here is irrelevant.
I believe each step is equal.
Oh, really?
They can't make an average scoring coffee better than what it is.
Okay.
So
okay.
Coffee is graded internationally by a system out of 100 points. And you see all these 90-plus coffees and things like that. It's very rare.
Yeah.
That's real. But I think the average, I would like to see, specialty coffee is graded from 80 points above.
Okay.
I don't think that's correct. I think it should be 84 and above, because the difference between an 80 scoring coffee and an 84 scoring coffee is immense. And the pricing has doubled as well between that 80 and that 84.
Yeah.
So our lowest scoring coffee is a decaffeinated washed Colombian coffee. It's a really good decaf. And if it was on if this was a cupping table with, you know, 30 Colombian coffees on, it would, you probably wouldn't be able to tell it was decaffeinated.
Really?
It's that good.
Wow.
So we score that at 83.5. But we pay a lot for it because it had to be processed in a different way to be decaffeinated. And previously we would have said that decaf was less than 2% of our business. It's a little bit more than that now. And then we have another decaffeinated coffee, which is actually a higher scoring coffee because it's still Colombian, but it was a naturally processed coffee and it's good.
Mm.
But I think it's our job when we get the samples each year. We get the fresh season sample each year, so we're doing that at the moment. To select the coffees we want to buy. And to answer your question for the farmer, I believe I'll stick with Colombia at the moment. We buy one or two containers, a 40-foot container of Colombian coffee. Probably 80% of that coffee will be an 85 scoring Asapep coffee, which is in our blend. I think it's our second strongest single origin that people buy because it's consistent. It's such a steady coffee. And then the other 20% will be it's probably 70%. And then there'll be the decaf coffee.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be some of the different honey processed coffees. And there'll be, we might get 120 sacks times four of some geishas, some naturally processed coffees. And we use those coffees as our premium or our rare and experimental. So we sell those in 250-gram bags. So we still sell a lot of them, but the bulk of the Colombian coffee will be that Colombian Asapep.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you can buy here from different places that are storing green beans. You can buy Colombian coffee from that same Tolima region. But there's also a very big range of quality from that coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of coffee that sits here for people to buy is not fresh. It's here, it's called spot coffee. So you draw down. So someone's bought that coffee in under whatever brand it might be, but it's from that region. And it's where the FARC used to be. So where all the conflicts and the kaka used to be grown. But there's a range of not only quality of varietals, but a big difference in the processing methods of the coffee. And then, so you might have 10 different coffees that are here that we can buy from the same region if we didn't want to buy direct, but they won't be the same quality as what we've got.
Yeah.
So you have to know when you get the sample, you have to have your sample roaster, you have your system, and you try and do it blind so you don't know what those coffees are. And then you select the ones you like by their score, and often that will be with my business partner and I, our head of roasting and our head of training, and we'll all do it, and we'll look, we'll value each person's opinion, because sometimes there'll be some of those special coffees that some people might really love and other people might just, that's not their thing, they don't like them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have to try and think about what your customers are looking for here as well, because I think while we love naturally processed coffees, there are definitely a much smaller group of people that like the really funky, whiny, naturally processed coffees.
Yeah.
Unless it's a Yemeni, for example, and people love and identify with their
that's a different story.
The heritage of Yemen.
Yeah.
And they're used to that. That's what they're good with it.
Yeah.
So it's just a balance of trying to work it out. And then we send back, okay, these are the coffees we like. Please give us the availability. Because, you know, some are only available in small lots. We often pre-commit. Like I just signed a pre-commitment today for Burundi, but we don't want the coffee until September. But they're harvesting soon. So we're committing to what we need for the next year. He'll then send us samples of the washed and the natural Burundi. And we've committed to a minimum amount, so he knows he's sold that. And then we wait, and
based
when
on
the samples
how the market
come,
goes.
Maybe we get some new customers that we're including that Burundi in the blends or offering that as a single origin. You know, we use certain coffees for cold brew, that we only use those coffees for cold brew. We don't use other coffees. So it's just like a forward planning.
Gotcha. And do you always buy like a year out? Is that the typical cycles?
Well, it
of
only
like your...
grows and harvested once a year. We don't want to miss out on the quality of the product we buy. And then we can't import during May, June, July, August.
Because of the heat.
Because of the heat, because it's really bad if it sits in the container. And, you know, it has GrainPro plastic that the coffee's in, but you don't want it to get to those high temperatures because of moisture and problems that
it'll
you
change
face.
Everything. Yeah.
So it's just a matter. And also we try to find out for the producing country where their challenge is. Because if we can bring it here and hold it here, we can do that. And, you know, sometimes that's good too because it staggers our payments that are going out, because doing it all at once is, you know, very painful.
I can imagine. Yeah.
But then other times they can hold it in parchment. So in Burundi, what they'll do is they'll hold the coffee in parchment for us. And that means that it has that dry husk on the outside of the coffee.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's really good. It keeps the coffee in a nice, stable warehouse and condition. And then just before it gets, they'll process it and take that husk off, polish it, then it will go down to the seaport and come to us. So it's just talking to them and finding out what works for them. They may not have the storage to do that for us.
Wow, there's just throughout the conversation, Kim, I'm just like listening to you speak, and I know coffee as an end consumer, and I drink it because I like it. Being in coffee, like you are, is just like all the things I worry about, and I'm just worrying about making one cup of coffee for myself. I'm just trying to take that and magnify it across a roastery and selecting coffees. And how do you just, it must be very difficult finding that balance. Like, it must be such a challenge.
I think it's like any industry, I'm sure. You need to take your time and look at the supply chain and understand each part of it. It's the detail.
Yeah.
The attention to detail.
Because you, correct me if I'm wrong, because from my understanding is when you first moved to Dubai, you had a cafe. And then you decided, you launched Raw in 2007. And mm-hmm. But in 2006, something happened where you're like, you couldn't find a good coffee supplier for the cafe. So you decided like, okay, I'll just go find one myself, I guess.
Yeah, I have three daughters and they all loved sailing. So we used to do a lot of sailing at the Jebel Ali Sailing Club and we'd camp there most weekends. It's in the old days. It was fantastic. And I ended up running the cafe there. And at that time, the only coffee you could buy, you had the local roasters here where they did the nuts and everything.
Yeah.
And then you had the imported Italian coffee.
Yeah.
So I come from New Zealand originally where we don't support franchises in New Zealand. Everyone had the small owner-operated bakeries or butchers or, you know, the old-fashioned sort of... And, you know, that there's good and bad things about that because, you know, they might be having a bad day. But I prefer supporting an owner-operated business. I think you get a much better quality. And I like those relationships. But I think the, we couldn't find coffee here. And then the sailing club here was down near, actually, where Taste of Dubai was on the weekend.
It was, yeah.
Skydive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the sailing club was. So when that was the sailing club was demolished and the marina was built, I had time and I had family and friends that were roasting coffee back in New Zealand. So I was like, oh, I wonder if I could do that here. And it was just an idea. Had I known everything that there was to learn
to go into it
and how long it was going to take, maybe I probably wouldn't have done it.
Mm, yeah.
But what I'm also, I didn't want to lose all that money.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't like failure.
Mm.
So I think it's just that tenacity, and when you own your own business you have to be like that.
You don't really have a choice.
Yeah,
the buck stops with you.
And it's, I do think the brand deserves to be doing well because we've tried to concentrate on the things that are real. We've tried to support the farmers because I do believe they are very, very important to the equation.
Yeah,
it's symbiotic. There's no way you can turn an 80 or an 81 scoring coffee into a great coffee. None at all. The only thing you can do is burn it and disguise it with that and adding syrups and things, which is what you see
in
a lot of the bigger chains because they can't afford, well, their investors will not allow the purchase of the higher scoring coffees.
Yeah.
But they'll use the word specialty. And then it's just really up to the end consumer, hopefully, to be able to distinguish between a good and a bad.
Yeah. And one thing about, on that point, distinguishing between the good and the bad. So sometimes people will say, like when I go to buy a coffee, the first thing I do is I'm looking at the flavor profile. Because just, and I've drank enough coffee by now and I've made it enough myself to know, like, if I see anything with that has chocolates or stone fruits or mm-hmm. one of those kind of mm-hmm. things. Probably not the ones that I'm mm-hmm. looking for, but if I look and I see like strawberry or plum or mm-hmm. anything, those kind of flavors, yep. That's where my eyes, you know, naturally mm-hmm. go. But I know what I like. For the person who doesn't and you're trying to get into coffee and yep. learn and taste things, typically what I would recommend to people, maybe you know much more than I do, but if I'm like, if you're trying a new way of having coffee, so let's say you've drank Nescafe your whole life and now mm-hmm. you're about to try a V60 for the first time, I'd be like, okay. Or whatever it is, espresso, V60. I'm like, let me give you something that tastes the most familiar to what you know. So the and what do people know if you've been drinking that kind of coffee most of your life, like just like a lot mm-hmm. of us were,
yeah.
is the Brazilians, the chocolatey, the caramelly, you mm-hmm. know, those flavors. You're mm-hmm. like, when I drink that, that is very reminiscent of a cup of coffee, much better than what I've had before, but tastes the same.
I think that you're right. You have to transition.
It
you
is.
Can't just,
yeah,
and if you don't drink black coffee, you're not going to like black coffee. So you have to start, if you usually drink a latte, you should try a latte. But if you...
Actually, that's good yeah, advice.
I think it's not trying to jump to the extreme. I think espresso, you know, I love espresso, but I drink brewed coffee at the moment because
yeah.
I want it to last longer. And I think a lot of the time, a good brewed coffee, you can really identify and distinguish the different flavors. Whereas an espresso is full on.
Yeah.
So when we do tastings with a commercial customer, for example, and we want to show them some options for their cafe or their restaurant, we will always ask them, what do you usually drink? Mm. Because if they drink a cappuccino, we should serve them a cappuccino. If they will try a black coffee, we like to do that because I think that's when you really get the flavor of the coffee.
Yeah.
But you also have to think about the respect or giving the respect to the milk-based coffees, because that's where 80% of the revenue coming into a cafe or a restaurant is still a milk-based coffee.
Which is crazy to me,
But you know, it can still be a very good flat white or a good cappuccino.
Of course, And that's, absolutely.
If that's what people want to drink, fantastic. But you can't make them drink a black coffee just because you think it's... we have certain coffees that we say actually it's better. Like we think our Ethiopian Guji is fantastic. We say this is really a good coffee for drinking black. You know, try it as a brewed coffee or a long black or an espresso. But, you can add milk, but we don't think that's going to present it in its best colours. But there's no way when we're doing a tasting with a sommelier or a manager of a restaurant, if they don't drink espresso, we can't give them an espresso to get them to evaluate the coffee.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's a... And I think just being kind, transitioning people, and then maybe they'll be more interested in the fact that it's locally roasted and it's fresh. So you could come with more...
A different angle.
...story and a sporting local. You know, I think... There's a lot more of this happening now where people want to support big local time, businesses. Yeah, for sure. They want to support brands that they think are aligned, you know, with their values.
Yeah, no, for sure. Because so for someone like me, seeing that much detail on like a coffee bag is resonates with me. But if I'm new to it, I feel I could look at that and be like, I just want a cup of coffee.
It can be very intimidating.
So is there a balance, or at the end of the day, you're just going to like, you're putting that as kind of like the, although it might be overwhelming to someone who's not familiar, but that's your first step into figuring out like, why did I like that coffee? You know, you're giving me the characteristics for me to go back to just like, oh, it tasted dark. No, what was in it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think it's a double-edged sword.
It is. Having amazing team that can be welcoming and can guide a customer on their individual preferences. I think that's why we've tried, our space is pretty industrial. It's very, it's not pretentious. And I think, you know, a lot of people, there's a lot of really funny Instagram pages that you can follow and things, you know, with how pretentious specialty coffee is. You know, I love our coffee. I love our industry, but it can be very
pretentious.
There's other words you can use, but pretentious.
Yeah.
So I think having a space that's welcoming, having team that are knowledgeable, having a team that are not trying to sell expensive coffee to someone that really is just entering their journey, and maybe also recognizing that you're wanting to encourage people. You know how you're saying you make your own coffee and it's a ritual. So during COVID, a lot of people started making their own coffee, a lot.
Mm.
And they had time to go online and follow YouTube classes and find their, you know, their guru that they wanted to follow on how to grind and all this type of thing. You know, and they got their scales and their grinders and they experimented with different origins and roast levels, everything. So that was great for our industry. That was amazing because once you've done that, you are not going to go back to that convenient...
You can't, yeah.
You know, cup of...
X. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
so it's that was really good for us. And I think what we have to do to genuinely grow the industry is to make that accessible to everybody. So we just got some crazy cool new toys last week. It's called a hoop. And it's two plastic cylinders that's recycled plastic. It has a round filter paper that you put inside the center cylinder. You put in 15 grams of coffee as if you were doing a V60 or a French press, however you like your grind size. And then you just add 250 mils to the outside chamber of 91, 92 water.
Mm-hmm.
Degrees to water, and then you just put it on your cup and you come back 4 minutes later and you have this perfectly brewed. Awesome. You don't need to stand there like a V60. And it was created by We've got some new grinders we're trialing at the moment that we actually really like. And it's from a company that's very innovative in Italy. And this was a tool that their engineers created to check to see that their grinders were consistently grinding their coffee correctly.
Okay.
So it's just a toy the engineers created that then the owner or the CEO of that company saw. And he's like, what's that? And they said, well, this is how we're testing our grinders to make sure that they're consistently doing what we think they're doing. And so he took it back to his office, played with it, and realized that he had a new brewing equipment.
Wow.
And it won the design award at the Specialty Coffee Association in Athens.
That's big.
Last year. Huge.
Wow.
And we just got 1,000 of them because they're like 139 dirhams. You can carry, they're not heavy. You can throw them around. You can put them in the dishwasher. And anybody can make a good coffee. And then to really be able to make that coffee well, you just need a hand grinder. And they're not expensive either.
No, they're not.
And then have your beans that you choose, that you like, and then you experiment, because if it's 15 grams to 250 mils, maybe you want it a little bit more, or maybe you want less water.
Yeah.
And that's how you experiment and play.
Yeah. It's interesting that there's a device like that to someone who maybe is looking to get into coffee and wants to start having that consistent experience without too much effort on their part.
Yes.
That's a great way to like enter.
Absolutely.
I think once you get in as far as maybe I am or you are and lots of other people I know, for me, I'm like, no. Even though that might guarantee me that, I'm like, it's about the process. I need to grind it.
But are they called toys or tools for you?
There's
always new toys. There's very always amazing new grinders. There's always amazing new brewing gadgets. There's always new roasters with, you know, young, funky, big marketing budgets. So there's always going to be something new. And yes, it's whether it's you categorize that as a toy or a tool.
That's
because
awesome.
You'll always be able to justify spending the money.
On coffee, for sure.
Yes.
For sure. Like I bought it's just sitting over there, just that, like a vacuum canister.
Yes.
I don't need that. I definitely don't need that. But, you know, once you get into that, like once you've got like the foundation set, you just start looking for little things like, maybe that water spray bottle or a WDT tool or whatever, you know, whatever the case might be. But I wanted to bring it back real quick to kind of what we've been touching on here, which is, how do we get people into coffee? What's the best way to do it? Now, I'm going to speak for myself and then I'll ask you the question. Mm-hmm. So I would be lying. So me and my friend we disagree on this thing. He's worked as a barista. Mm-hmm. So anything for coffee, I go to him because he's that level above me. So if I see, I've become, to be very honest, a bit of a coffee snob, but I'm not going to lie. I might not, if I see you drinking something, I'm going to say like, hey, why are you drinking that? But internally, I'm judging you. You know, there's for sure some judgment. And but from his perspective as a barista, he's like, my job is to give you your coffee in the way that you want it, not in the way that I think it should be, you know, had. So I wanted to ask you, do you get those feelings too?
We've had to get over ourselves.
Well, there you go.
We've had to get over ourselves because, you know, at the beginning, we've helped other businesses that are quite well known here with their coffee get going. We've roasted their coffee and there'd been no decaf and the milk only heated to 60 degrees, for example, and if you don't like that, go somewhere else. And I think that's something you might be able to do in Melbourne, but I'm not sure it's a tack that we think is very clever to try and do that here, because the market was evolving, it was maturing. It's a much more mature market now. Like, I think it's definitely caught up. And we actually had a meeting yesterday with some amazing people where it's like, how do we then elevate it even further? Because, you know, we're equal now with the quality of what is on offer, whether it's London, Wellington, San Francisco, Melbourne. The UAE, Dubai, is doing incredibly well with their coffee. So how do we now jump ahead.
That's exact, and that was literally what I wanted to ask you about, because you said the last podcast, he's like, we were behind, but we caught up quickly. So then the question is, okay, now that we've caught up, two things come up. What do we need to do to, I guess, be, you know, leading, I guess, the charge or innovating in the coffee industry globally? But the second question then becomes, from my perspective, is, but what makes up an affluent or 21st century coffee market? Because based on that, when you were saying, oh, we were 5 years behind Melbourne, for example, what were we behind? What were we lacking? Was it the number of roasters? Is it the level, the variety of coffee, the quality of the overall coffee that's in the country? You know, what are the metrics that define that this is where we were lacking, and now how do we move forward?
I believe the market is completely oversaturated, for sure.
Oversaturated. Okay.
And when that happens, whatever happens globally, you can expect to happen here. So we're not inventing the wheel.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's a trend, to have that oversaturation, because there's been the early adopters and now there's new people, which is fine. But, you know, those businesses to sustain and remain and be viable, they're going to have to work really hard, because there's not enough consumers for the volume of coffee roasters and cafes. So they're going to have to keep elevating their offering to attract the customers and keep their customers. I think when I used to say that we were behind, it was the quality of what was offered, not the volume of options.
Okay.
So it was knowledge. So knowledge of the operator and knowledge of the consumer.
Got you. Okay.
Now we have a far more discerning consumer, and we have more operators that understand and know what they're doing, which is great. We need that for the industry. I think it's on the radar globally because, you know, look at how busy World of Coffee is and all the countries that come with their, you know, their businesses, because they recognize that the Middle East is an attractive market for them to come to. And this is an easier place to start than, you know, some of the other bigger countries.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think it's, for me, it's all about quality.
Okay.
And then to have quality and to innovate and lead, we have to do what I believe we do as a business, where it has to be everything. It has to be the training of the people that are making the product. It has to be the training of introducing new people to coffee. So foundation brewing classes, foundation sensory, foundation barista for people that want to. That's a great way of learning.
Awesome.
And it's very enlightening.
For
you
know, sure.
And you it commands respect because you learn so much. It's brilliant. I think the right equipment, the right attention to water, fresh product each year, not sitting on old stock trying to sell it because people don't know that they're buying 2 or 3 year old green beans, which is a problem that we have.
Because I guess the roast on that point, because I guess the roast date could be misleading.
Yep.
Because I'll see on the back, oh, roasted on this day. I'll be like, oh, that's pretty fresh. So I'd leave it, needs some degassing time, maybe a month, two weeks, you know. But I never considered how long was it.
Has it been green?
Yeah. How long has it been there for? I never thought of that, actually. That's a good point.
So, you know, that is an issue.
Yeah.
And then maybe trusting your roaster. Because like you say, if we put down that the roast date's the 1st of March, should be the 1st of March, you know, and it's the attention to each part of the chain.
Yeah.
You can't execute an exceptional experience without that attention to detail. You can't take shortcuts.
Yeah.
You know, some of these big global brands went to automatic equipment because it's harder to have a barista and to do it manually. You will never, it doesn't matter, I don't care what the big equipment manufacturers say, that you will never get as good a product from automatic equipment as you will from a traditional espresso machine.
That's for sure.
And you can be just as fast, but maybe you need two people on the machine. So, you know, that's actually how to cut cost, how to increase margin.
Okay.
You know, do you want to do that, or do you want to lead an industry?
Where is it then, I guess, sorry to interrupt you, Kim, but where is it, I guess, then do you see that people, most coffee places take the shortcuts? Where is, what area in the supply chain are most shortcuts taken? Let's say that.
Buying cheaper green bean because they think they can make more margin.
Okay.
Not training their staff.
Okay.
Because they're worried that if they have empowered and trained their staff, they'll be taken by a competitor. I believe it's the opposite. I think you have to train and empower your staff. Otherwise, they are the front facing. They are the actual, they're between the grinder and the cup. You know, there's nothing.
Nothing more important than that.
Yeah, you have to concentrate on your team for sure. Cutting costs. I think there's, unfortunately, it's very popular and trendy to be in this industry at the moment. And there's waves of different industries that happen. At the moment, it's just coffee. And some people have built the most beautiful cafes. Beautiful. But they don't, either they're not in the right location.
That's a big one, yeah.
Or they don't have enough foot traffic. And they might have too many overheads, you know, too many staff.
Yeah.
So it's to be more experienced and really think about your business plan pre-opening. Make sure you've thought of everything.
Yeah.
And who your competitors are, because there's a lot of competition.
Yeah. You were saying, I think when you started, you guys were maybe one of the first couple local coffee roasters. Now there's over 375 or something registered things.
Yeah.
So I was curious from that perspective, because I'm just trying to look overview. I'm like, how are people competing here? Because, so for example, Martin, the friend that I was mentioning, so he was working as a barista in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So he's at Khaled there to find a geisha. There's like, out of 20 places, one maybe has one. If you don't have a geisha, you're not even in the game. He's like, it's not normal the choice you have here, the level of choice you have here as well. So I'm like, okay, so it's not going to be the quality of the coffee, because across the board it seems to be a very high quality. Is it going to be the brewing of it? That could be it. Is it going to be, because even as a roastery, if I'm buying my beans from somewhere, what differentiates me from another roaster? Because we could buy the same green beans.
Yeah, and people do.
Yours might come out one way, mine may come out completely differently.
Yeah, exactly.
What sets them apart? What sets you guys apart? And I guess let's focus on the roasting arena.
Knowledge and experience. I think we learned to roast manually before everything was available.
Yeah.
So we understand the science behind it.
Exactly.
We were the first to know that it's important to roast just what you need for the week, you know, so it's always fresh. Mm. I see a lot of coffee. I've tried a lot of coffee at events, which we know the coffee that is under-extracted. So it hasn't been developed when it's been roasted, because there's this perception that a lighter roast is how these coffees should be presented for brewing. And I believe that's a big mistake. And I think it's probably trying to follow trends that we might see in Scandinavia or somewhere they are way more appreciative of higher acidity coffee.
That's my kind of vibe, yeah.
Yeah, that complexity.
Yeah.
Whereas they're misunderstanding that, and they're actually not developing that coffee properly. So some of the roasting is not done correctly either.
Mm.
And that is an art, and it's something that is not just, you've got to be able to replicate it as well.
And there you go.
So consistency again.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good point, because, so for example, I've been ordering recently, I was always going to, for years, I was going to Cypher,
mm-hmm.
and I know, you know, Muhammad, shout out Muhammad if you're watching this, and I've always loved their coffee and stuff, but I was buying so often and so frequently that I'd had literally every single coffee you could probably have at the place.
Mm-hmm.
So now me and a few friends started ordering ours from a place in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason is the flavor profiles that I'm seeing there, it's like a dream for me, you know, like combinations and stuff. But a lot of it is, I would guess, lighter roasted, because the flavors that I'm looking for typically come with a lighter, more acidic roast.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it could also be their water. Their water may be more higher in mineral content. So the coffee needs that to
that help
latch onto you have that flavor. But yeah, I honestly, it's not like having a favorite bottle of scotch. All you have to do is open. Not,
exactly.
Or wine or whatever. There are so many things. And you can give the same coffee to multiple roasters around the world and it will all taste different. Because, you know, you've got the Lorings that have got a different way of working that impact the flavor of the coffee. You have the older probats that don't have the cyclones to extract the smoke. You have, air roasters. Mm. All of those different roasters have an impact on the flavor of the coffee as well.
Yeah, yeah. And kind of listening to you speak, I feel like it's harder to produce a more consistent cup of coffee than is to produce like a consistent bottle of wine, for example.
Absolutely.
You know, because that's just in one barrel. From this barrel, everything from this barrel is going to taste the same.
And then you, with the what you like, you're in a minority.
Yeah, I know.
Which is great.
Yeah, I'm very happy.
Yeah, yeah. But that's your evolution.
It's just what I've naturally, I guess, went towards rather than, the darker, more robustas and that kind of stuff is a bit more.
Oh, for sure.
Not my cup of tea or coffee, as they say. But I was thinking, so, because you guys were discussing how the Indian coffee market is starting to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me start reflecting on, okay, where do I usually get my coffee from? It's 90% of the time is going to come from a couple of key areas, either Ethiopia, Panama, Colombia. Recently, I've started having some from Ecuador. That's a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But there's like geographic key locations.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, I've had coffee, for example, that's come from China. I've had coffee that's come from random places that I wouldn't have expected out of, let's say, the Africas or the South Americas.
Yeah.
So Indian coffee, for example, now that that's picking up. I've never had an Indian cup of, like an Indian coffee that I would brew, for example, in the way that I would like make any of these. So my question then, I was thinking, I'm like, how hard is it for a new, I don't know what you would call that, but a new
region or origin
to break through into a market and to become like on the same level of like the Kenyas and the Ethiopias and stuff? Because I'm like, how does that happen and when does it happen?
Usually what we've seen is their coffee board will invite a really well-respected industry specialist.
Okay.
So there's a guy called Andrew Herzl who founded Coffee Quality Institute, which was, the beginning of Q Grade. And he is very much focused on the supply chain, the green part, the farming origins of coffee.
Okay.
He knows everything, but he's someone that we really look up to. He's amazing. So he would be brought into a country. He's been to India. He's been to Myanmar. So he'll look at everything and work out where there can be improvements made. They usually involve him at a stage or someone like him where they'll invite roasters like us and we go down to Myanmar or they go to India or wherever it will be. And they take you on a week tour of different regions where you see the farms, you see the processing mills, you go to cupping stations, where they do the washing and the producing. So I believe that's the main way that a new country can elevate their coffee pricing and recognition. And get it out to many countries quickly by bringing in roasters and doing it that way. And for example, we've been down twice now to Myanmar. They were already growing coffee there and it was already perfect conditions, soil, altitude, weather, sun, varietal, really good coffee. It was all naturally processed coffee. And what they used to do, they grow tea there as well and mandarins and other things. They were using it as a cash crop. So it was grown near the house in the villages. And then when the women needed money, they'd pick some of their coffee, dry it, and take it to a market. By consolidating and the whole village's coffee and bringing someone like Andrew in and looking at how it was dried and processed, they were able to increase the productivity and the money they earned by more than 3 times.
Wow.
Per kilo, per pound, whatever, however they want to weigh it.
Wow.
And then they automatically had an international range of customers that wanted to buy that product. And we would go to these cuppings, and Matt and I knew which coffees we wanted to buy because we know what we think our customers are looking for. Whereas friends that we met from Iceland and Vienna and other places, New Zealand, they knew what their customers were looking for. So they were able to partner communities, like the community we buy from, they only do 21 sacks of coffee a year.
Oh, wow.
But it's really good coffee, really beautiful coffee. And we don't mind paying 3 times more than what they were paying because it's still, for what it is, it's a really beautiful coffee and we can still make money from it.
Yeah.
I think the going there and doing things like that as a roaster are imperative because we also then get to take content for our social media stories, our website. Mm-hmm. We took some of their coffee back down to make for them with hand grinders and brewed it with them to show them because they'd never tried their own coffee.
Wow.
Because they've never drunk it.
Yeah.
They don't drink it. They export it. And you see that in, you know, Yemen as well. They drink the skin, the husk that they make.
The cascara.
Kisha. Yeah. So they make a drink, a tea with the skin because the coffee is too valuable a product, a commodity for them to drink or consume. So, wow, you know, okay. For India, I sit on the fence with it at the moment. I'm really happy for them that their industry is growing every year because we're quite close to India. We get a lot of coffee samples given to us and we haven't found one we want to buy yet. That could change in the future.
Of course,
that
yeah.
could change in the future. Yeah. In fact, we did actually find one, but then it wasn't available for whatever reason. And I think it was only very small, maybe only 4 sacks or something like that. And it was a young guy who's quite experimental and he's actually working as a barista. So he's trying to make.
Okay.
And we see the same in Nepal. So.
Interesting. Okay.
It'll come
yeah.
if it's meant to.
Okay. If it's.
But again, for us, it will be on the quality.
That's where it's going to come down.
It's the cup score on the quality. Mm, it's gotcha. Not that it's going to be close and less expensive for shipping. It's not that it's less expensive to buy.
Yeah.
Or that we can buy it in volume.
Yeah.
We don't even have any coffee from Brazil. We're not looking for those coffees. We're looking for coffees that we really like drinking.
Yeah. And I think that makes the most sense. And I think always bringing it back to what your consumer wants is what, you know.
That's, and a little bit what we want, I suppose, because we are guiding some of that behavior.
Exactly, because I just want to be conscious of our time, so I'll just try to wrap it up.
Okay.
One thing I've learned, because you touched on it on the last podcast, which was about how coffee culture is just different around the world.
Mm-hmm.
My connection as a Arab to coffee is different than your connection mm-hmm. to coffee, and how Italians drink espresso that's burnt to hell, but they drink it and it's standing up, and others are different. So, and I'm sure throughout this whole, you know, coffee journey, you've met and been to some incredible places, met incredible people all through this beautiful product of
yep.
culture of coffee.
Yes.
So I kind of just wanted to round off our conversation today in the sense that what has that experience taught you about, I guess, people and the world?
I love people talking about how they grew up drinking coffee, wherever they're from.
Mm.
So whether they're from Eastern Europe or Asia, you know, they've got, and your heritage with coffee is beautiful. And, you know, a lot of the extended family and, you know, everything was made fresh in the house. So they had the green beans, they roasted in themselves. It was a real ritual that the, you know, the grandmothers or whoever it was, you're so lucky because they're not going to, it was part of the hospitality to any guests that came into the house. They're not going to make it bad.
Yeah.
They've worked out how to make it,
yeah,
hey?
Yeah, that's true,
and then,
very true.
And then there's always going to be a certain element to the conditions in your country. So if water is a really valuable commodity and you don't have a lot of water, it will be a naturally processed coffee.
Mm.
You know, and there's all those things to take into account too. If you've got cows and grass, like New Zealand has, you know, with flat whites. If not, you know, maybe you've always drunk coffee black.
Yeah.
And then to learn those stories, I think, is something that's this beautiful tapestry of, you know, colour. And it's part of why Dubai is such a great place to live in, because, yeah, you know, of all these different cultures here.
Yeah.
Japanese, they love their brewed coffee, and they love they understand water and temperature, and the detail is just impeccable.
Different level over there. Yeah, yeah. It's
just, and then, you know, Jordan with their, you know, and Turkey with their Turkish coffee. You know, I'll drink Turkish coffee when I'm in Turkey and those countries, because I really, it's part of the experience of travel.
Sure. No, 100%. And I guess listening to you describe why, for example, you know, things happen a certain way, why a flat white would be more resonate more with like New Zealand and stuff. I'm like, oh, all this makes sense, but you never, just as an end user, I rarely connect, you know, those dots. You rarely go that extra step and be like, that's why they drink it like that. That's why they drink it like that. And I think what I love about coffee, and I think anyone who appreciates coffee likes it for similar reasons. I think one is you will never be bored. You will never not be on the hunt for a new different type of coffee from a place that you've never heard of, that's processed in this new way.
Mm-hmm.
So like on a personal level, I just love it. Yes, does it help me wake up? Yes, but I drink it 99% for the taste more than, you know, for anything. I always try to, like, if someone hasn't had like a V60 before or something, you know, I remember my experience. So now anyone that comes over and they're like, what do you do and how do you do it? It's a fun thing to share with people. And there's a whole world that I think as time goes on, people are going to start drinking more coffee, not less, because there's going to be so many new ways and techniques or toys or tools to get me into it. Kim, I could say this is the beginning, I hope, of many more conversations, because I barely scratched the surface
I enjoy it too. If that was an hour, that went very fast.
That was, we're just coming up to an hour 15, actually. Amazing. And I want to be conscious of your time. So just for my last two questions for, let's call it round one.
Okay.
Looking back, either personally or professionally, when I ask you the question, what are you most proud of for yourself? What would you say?
Oof. That it survived. Because at the beginning, there were many years that I didn't know if it was going to.
That's a massive accomplishment.
Yeah,
though.
So that it survived.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for the future. So I think it would be that it's in like a, at, I, you know, I'm not young. So to be in a position where I get to learn all the time, that's exciting. And I'm excited for what's coming.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think there's a lot of interesting coffee things coming up very, very soon.
Yeah.
And the innovation is never going to stop, because and as time goes on, and I know with climate and stuff, that coffee is becoming harder to make and to produce and to that level. So it's just, you know, a breeding ground for innovation that's going
to
come.
Something that concerns me, like, I think we have to keep focused on our supply chain for the farmers, because, like you say, the El Nino or the environmental or water or volcanoes or whatever it's going to be, if we don't help them, there will be no good coffee.
Exactly.
Because they could be growing things that they can probably earn more money from. So we're seeing a lot of places. I know that it was quite disturbing for Matt to see how many coffee trees have been pulled out in Ethiopia, because there's a lot of problems there. So, you know, it's very subsistent lifestyle. They need that income. So if they're not getting it from the coffee, they'll pull it out and they'll grow something else.
Exactly.
I think they're growing eucalyptus trees, and they're cutting the wood and selling the wood.
Oh, wow.
And cart.
Yeah. There you go.
So, you know, it's devastating.
Yeah. And for something, for such a beautiful product that is consumed by millions, I think sometimes we don't realize how close we are to that supply chain.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think one thing I would love to see is, with all the AI and all of the tech innovations that there are, that, that there will be more provenance to the product.
For sure, yeah.
So that you can see whether, you know, at the farm gate, the price, you can see where the value's added, because that will blow lots of competitors out of the water straight away.
100%.
But it will also really add humongous value to the farmers.
Exactly. I hope, I'm optimistic. I hope there's more good days coming for coffee than bad.
I hope so too.
And for my last question, Kim, what is the message you'd like everyone to take home with them today?
Don't let it be intimidating if you don't, if you haven't started this journey. I think just find a place where you feel comfortable, where you're personally, you feel comfortable, and ask for a little bit of advice and guidance, because it's a really fun journey. And it might not suit everybody, but you can have a matcha or a drinking chocolate or whatever you want to have. But very rarely are there people who don't try a very well brewed coffee for the first time and go, oh wow, I've never tried coffee like this before.
Exactly.
This is awesome.
Yeah. And once I think, and that's the aha, moment.
It's great.
Because once you say that, you will never, you'll never go back.
Yeah.
Kim, I wanted to say thank you so, so much for coming on the show. You're someone I've always wanted to, speak to. I love coffee. So speaking to someone who's not been in it for 17 years and built one of the most, you know, reputable brands here, I always like learning about, and if it's talking about coffee, I can speak forever. So thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. If people want to connect with you, work with you, reach out, where, what's the best place for us to get in touch?
Raw Coffee Company, Kim at rawcoffeecompany.ae. If there's any questions or anything. Yeah, sure. I also love talking coffee, so it's easy. That was the fastest hour. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Kim. It was an absolute pleasure. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Please make sure to like, share, and follow to the podcast. I hope it helps. Pod across all channels. And as always, guys, hope it helps. Peace.